flying in a piece of World War II history with some of the guys who made that history. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Thanks for downloading this special feature. Don't those engines sound great? On Thursday, May 31st, the Experimental Aircraft Association's restored B-17, aluminum overcast, made a stop at the Portland Hillsboro Airport in Oregon, less than a mile from my home. I wasn't about to miss this opportunity to catch a ride in an authentically restored flying fortress, and I was also looking forward to talking with some of the World War II veterans who made history in these planes over Europe. So, early on a beautiful sunny day, I headed over to the airport. The flight was carrying a local TV morning show crew, who had the plane strung with lots of cables and microwave equipment to do a live segment. But there were also three veterans who flew missions over Europe during World War II on that flight. Vaughn Erickson was one of those guys. He took a few minutes to chat after we got off the plane. I started by asking Vaughn about his personal experiences with the B-17 and how he got started.
When I joined the Air Force, I took my training in five different bases and finally ended up with the group, 398th Bomb Group, in Rapid City, South Dakota. And we did our training there for about 4 months in April 44. We left there and went to England, and that's where our group started flying the missions.
Now, you grew up not too far from here in Vancouver, or in the north of Vancouver, Washington, right?
Yes.
One of your earliest exposures to aviation was as a young man riding a bicycle down to Pearson Air Base and watching planes fly back then. You were an early airport rat.
I guess that's what you'd call me, yeah. It was a lot of fun to watch the old planes take off and land, and that's when you flew by the seat of your pants, I guess you'd say.
This plane is a very, very different experience from any modern aircraft when you get into it, because obviously there are lots of hard surfaces and exposed sharp edges and control cables running overhead. Tell us a little bit about what kind of training went into becoming a crew member on one of these planes.
First of all, I went from basic training to Denver, Colorado, and to a tech school that was 12 miles out of Denver, and I was there for a couple months, and then I moved closer to Denver to Lowry Field, and that was another tech school, and I spent 2 months in that, and then from there they shipped me to Kingman, Arizona for the gunnery school. And I had never shot a gun before.
Any gun?
BB gun, that was all. And we went out to the skeet range, and we were all shooting skeet, the clay pigeons. And the sergeant, he says, have you ever shot a gun? I said, no. So I got up to the stations and did my firing. I hit 25 out of 25.
Oh.
And the sergeant, he said, I thought you told me you didn't fire a gun before. And I said, I haven't. So maybe they decided I should be a gunner then.
I was going to say, that probably secured which seat in the airplane would be assigned to you.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
Well, now tell us what it was like flying these things in hostile conditions, because the thing that struck me sitting in this during the flight was that there's no way you can make an aircraft very resistant to even small arms fire without making it too heavy to fly. Did you guys think about that a lot when you were flying these missions, or did you just kind of have to push it out of your mind?
Well, mostly I think everybody just kind of pushed it out of their mind and did the job we had to do. And of course, we watched the flak bursts all the time. And if they got too close, that's when we got a little nervous. And as far as fighters, we could shoot back at them, but the flak we couldn't shoot at. I hated it worse than the fighters. And usually the fighters would come in either head-on or from the tail. And maybe you'd get one, two, three, maybe bursts at the most. because if they come in from the head on, they were going so fast, it was just a blur when they went by. I remember over Munich, I went there four times. Over Munich, one time we had heavy flak, and I got a piece of flak in my leg. The reason I did is because I wasn't in the ball turret. And the reason I wasn't in the ball turret is because after we caught on fire, the pilot said, from now on, you get out of there when we hit the IP, which was the initial point that the bombardier took over, and he flew the plane. And that was usually maybe a five-minute run. And I got out of there at the IP, and I was up in the waist of the ship, right where I was standing in this one. And that's where I caught this thing.
Well, now, I noticed that just in conversation here, you just pulled it out of your pocket. Do you carry that with you everywhere you go or just on these trips?
Not everywhere, but it's a good luck piece. It could have done a lot more damage than what it did.
We'll hear more of this special feature in a moment. You're listening to Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Okay, you got the license and now you're renting or even own a plane. Now what? Hi, I'm Tom Gresham, host of Wings to Adventure Television, and every week on the Outdoor Channel, we show you incredible places you can visit in your plane. Shot in spectacular high definition, Wings to Adventure captures cool planes, interesting people, and fly-in getaways you haven't heard of. Plus, we always have fun. There's more info at wingstoadventure.com.
Welcome back to our Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack. I'm talking today with Vaughn Erickson, one of my fellow passengers, about the EAA's B-17 aluminum overcast. When I asked Vaughn about the last time he flew one of these planes in combat, he pulled out a tiny pocket diary with yellowed, faded pages and what appeared to be a picture of himself in his 20s. I noted that he'd been carrying the diary for more than 60 years.
Yeah. I think the last three missions I didn't write down. The one I remember, though, was it was to Saarbrücken, and we flew at 26,500 feet, August 3rd, 1944. 6.5 hours flying, 5 hours on oxygen, bombed the rail yards, had very little flak, no fighters, and no holes in the ship. That was the last mission for my pilot and co-pilot and navigator.
What was it like to get back on board one of these after all those years? And I guess the first time was in the Seattle area. What did it feel like? Did it bring back more than you were ready for?
Let's just describe it. The airplane is still. And what I mean by that, it's still breezy, still noisy, still rattly, and still the best airplane there is.
Well, Vaughn, tell us briefly about the 398, because your unit has a special connection to this particular aircraft.
Well, the Triangle W was our group, 398th Bomb Group, with the big red tail. And we were in the 1st Division, 1st Wing. And there was the 351st, I believe, over about 10 miles from us, and the 91st Bomb Group, which had a Triangle A. We flew together mostly as a real big group. And a lot of times we would take off and get up to 10,000 feet to form into formation, and you'd see somebody drop out with an engine going out or whatever. Usually, though, we had pretty good luck, and very few planes had to abort.
I think you were telling me earlier that you had a situation when you were in that ball turret where you got a bird's eye view, maybe a better than a bird's eye view of some engine trouble.
Yeah, it was a bird's eye view, I guess you'd call it, horizontal. I heard the co-pilot call up that number three engine was on fire and prepare to bail out. I swung my turret around and flames were shooting almost back to the tail surface. So I got out of there, I snapped my chute on and was going to bail out, and my waist gunner stopped me. And the time it took me to get out of that, they had feathered it, and the fire blew out. And then 4 or 5 minutes later, we got number two engine, and it was throwing oil, and we shut it down. We were losing altitude, and we threw out a few things that we could get a hold of. Finally, we held our own, and we were straggling back from the other part of the group, and we were probably down to 15,000 feet by then, or 10,000. And we picked up a couple of P-51s, and they escorted us all the way back to England. I feel very fortunate.
You know, I thought going into this that the most special part of the aluminum overcast experience would be the plane and its technology. But the chance to talk with Vaughn and some other vets about their experiences was the real high point. If you get a chance, fly on aluminum overcast. And don't miss the chance to talk with your fellow passengers. The generation that saved the world is rapidly disappearing. Don't miss the chance to hear these stories from the men who lived through them. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.